So will the Jews be wiped out? Will they be murdered? This is where we're at the climax of our story. There's been intrigue, treachery, lies, deceit. And Haman, he is the viceroy, second most powerful person in the world. He's planning on committing genocide against the Jews. And the story this week, it revolves around a meal, a kind of a drinking banquet. There's the king, Xerxes, most powerful man in the world. He's Persian, born into a Persian family, spoke Persian. His dad, Darius, was the emperor of the Persians. He's inherited that. He's as Persian as they get. Then you have Esther, who everyone thinks is Persian, but she's not. She was born into an ethnically Jewish home. And she's kept her identity secret. Then you have Haman. He's the viceroy. He's the second most powerful man in the whole world behind Xerxes. And he's an Amalekite. Now, the Amalekites have an ancient ethnic, what we might call in today's language, a racial feud between the Jews and the Amalekites. There's this feud, and he's going to use his power and privilege to try to wipe them out. Now, because these sort of ethnic tensions or racial tensions play such a big part in today's story, and because there's been so much insanity in the news this last week, instead of just establishing that point, I want to take a step back and undress this issue a little bit for everybody. I know many of you have been anxious. Many of you have felt tense. I certainly have at the news that's come out throughout the whole world about things that have happened primarily in the United States, which has spilled over into other countries. Even here in London, there's been protests and things. We want to see these things through a biblical lens. I do, because they're very emotionally charged. In my own city of Richmond, where I grew up, and I lived until the age of 20 before I came to this side of the Atlantic, there was some crazy stuff that happened in my home city. And friends of friends, so I have some friends, and their friend, my friend of a friend, he was a pillar of the community. A great man. He happens to be of dark pigment, of dark skin, what many would call an African American. And he was a pillar of his community, and in the protests and the rioting, his shop was burned down, totally destroyed. He lost everything. And my friends are just completely shattered and grieved over this, you know. And other people I know have had bad things happen during this time. And it's a tragic time. Whether we know people who have been personally involved or not, it's been in our face. And when we're hit emotionally, when we grieve, when we see something, there can be this tendency to react and react quickly and say something and get sort of swept up in the political, social divisiveness of our day and kind of take on one of the social narratives or one of the political narratives that are so strong that we can pick up on social media and pick up in the news. And the Bible wants us to, no, the Bible provides certain lenses for us to interpret the events. There, in this world, whenever we encounter an event, a tragic event or a good event or any other event, there's the event itself and then there's the way we interpret it, the way we filter it through our narratives. And when we come to Christ, you know, we're born into a certain culture or certain paradigms for certain narratives. But when we come to Christ, part of the renewing of our mind and becoming a disciple is learning to interpret events through new lenses, through new paradigms, through new filters. And I want to take a moment not to so much give social commentary. You guys don't come to church to get social commentary. You have your news websites and blogs you go to and things to get that. But I am trying to give a biblical perspective on what it is that we call racism. So when we see ethnic injustice or racial injustice in the world around us, and everybody does, whether you're a Christian, an atheist, a Muslim, Jewish, whatever, we all encounter corporate injustices. What are the things we need to keep in mind, the truths from Scripture we need to keep in mind when we encounter this? Well, first of all, at the very beginning of the Bible, it establishes there's actually only one race. We use the term racism, but implicit in that term that's developed is that there are different races of creatures. And this is a very materialistic, highly evolutionary view of the world around us, that, you know, there were these primates and in different ways they kind of evolved into these humanoids, and various humanoids went to Neanderthals and humans came out, and it is happening randomly in different parts of the world. Okay. And that we are different races, essentially. The Bible says that all of humanity came from one couple. Now, my goal here is not to discuss creation versus evolution so much. I realize Christians have some different views on things like the age of the earth and could God have used evolution in some way to help produce humanity? Okay, that's like an important discussion, but we're just going to keep that for a different time. I'm simply saying that the Bible affirms we are not randomly evolved, hyped up monkeys that came from different directions. We are one race. And it doesn't matter if people have different hair features or lack of hair features. It doesn't matter the color of their eyes. It doesn't matter their accents or what language they speak. It doesn't matter how much pigment is in their skin or anything else. If you go back far enough, we're all related. We are one big family. Paul affirms this in Acts 17 when he's talking to the very sophisticated Athenian philosophers. He's saying, hey, it's from one couple that God made the whole world, or for all of humanity. So this is affirmed throughout the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament. And our term, the very term racism is something that comes from a different worldview than the Christian worldview. We might still use it, okay, but we need to qualify it when we say it. We are one family, not different families. It's broken down into different tribes and different branches, but go back far enough and we're all related. We got the same type of blood flowing through us. Now, the second thing we want to keep in mind is we shouldn't be surprised when these things happen. I don't mean we're not grieved or horrified. I don't mean we don't weep or move deeply with compassion, but we're not surprised. Because in Genesis 1 and 2, yes, God makes the first couple and we see that we're all descended from the same people. That's our great dignity that we share. But then Genesis 3 comes and that couple, you know, there's a lust for power on the part of the first man and the woman. They don't want to follow God's rules and his ways. They want to be the king and queen of the universe. And they reach out and try to grab hold of that power. They want a beauty and an integrity and a justification for existence that they have on their own apart from God. And then that's how sin enters the world. And all of a sudden, this world is separated, in a sense, from God. It's not happening according to his original design. He gives them over in judgment to what they want. He says, okay, you want a world without me? There you go. A lot of times in the Bible, judgment is just God giving us what we want, what we think we want. And so sin comes in the world, the separation from God. What happens then in Genesis 4? Cain murders Abel. Brother murders brother. That happens then throughout the rest of the Bible. It happens throughout human history. It happens today, where you see one son of Adam murdering another son of Adam. This continues to happen. Being sons and daughters of Adam and Eve, that is our glory, that is our dignity, but it is also our shame. The third thing we keep in mind, that as Christians, we are commanded to be listeners. James says this in James chapter 1, verse 19. He says, now, brothers and sisters, let everyone be slow to speak and quick to listen, because the anger of mankind will not work righteousness. It will not work a godly righteousness. And we see this a lot of times when revolutions happen throughout human history. You know, an oppressed group sees privilege and wealth at the top and they want it. And there's a lust for power and a legitimate one very often. But they choose to address those injustices through ungodly means. And great horrors happen. A lot of times the cure is just as bad, if not worse, than the original problem. We see this in the French revolutions. We see this in the Bolshevik revolutions in Russia, in countless other ways. Throughout Asia in the 20th century, the very communist revolutions, that millions of people being murdered. So we are slow to speak. It doesn't mean we don't do anything. It doesn't mean we don't say anything, but we're slow to do so. We take in all the facts. On my phone, I have various news apps that help me do this. When I check the news in the morning, I have some that are kind of lean a bit to the right and some that lean a bit to the left and some from different countries. And I have a French one, a British one, an American one. And why? Because all these different news sites that are fighting for my clicks, that want me to click on them, you know, they all try to weave a simple narrative and a story to get me caught up emotionally. So I click on their website more often. That's the tendency. I'm not saying reporters or editors do that on purpose, but that tends to be that's the human tendency. To simplify things into a simple narrative that can fire up on our emotions. Listen to people who are different from you. Listen to people who have different politics than you. Listen to people who are socially, politically different, ethnically different. Listen to people from other countries, what their perspective is. And I'm not saying that, oh, you just got to agree with everyone. No. I mean, yeah, have your opinions, have your point of view. But as you're forming your opinions, as you're forming your point of view, listen, try to learn something from everybody else, even if they're radically different from you. And even if you're opposed to them on so many different issues, maybe there's just one thing you can learn. That's the mark of being humble. The mark of a humble person is they think there's something they can learn from just about anybody, regardless of where they stand on the political or ethnic spectrum. We're quick to listen, and we're careful to jump on bandwagons. Because as Christians, when we face injustice, we do it with two things at the very center. One, we have a God of justice who created this world to work in a just way and who will one day judge the world. Okay? That is what we're headed to, a great judgment. And though that personally may cause us to fear because of the sin we have done, that's really good news for the world and the universe, that one day God will step into human history and bring about justice. Nobody will get away with anything on the day that God judges the world. That's part of the Apostles' Creed from the very foundations of Christianity. Jesus Christ is coming back to judge the quick and the dead, or the living and the dead. That is our great hope, that he will bring justice to the world. And also that he has come as a redeemer to turn unjust people into just people. That's called justification. He's coming to justify us, because naturally none of us are perfectly just, and naturally none of us do perfect justice in our interpersonal relationships, whether individually or corporately. And Christ has come back to redeem that. Now, if you take those two things out, which the world around us does, it has all these other ways of addressing injustices, which as believers, we don't think will really get to the heart of the issue, because the heart of the issue is one of self-righteousness. Ethnic, you know, rivalries, what we call racism very often, this is rooted in human pride. If you're not receiving your sense of righteousness, of purpose, of goodness, that if you're not justified in this universe as a free gift from a generous God, which leaves you humble, which leaves you joyful, if you're not receiving it in that way, you have to go out and earn it in some sort of human sense, which can leave you feeling proud, looking down on others individualistically. You know, we want to be more beautiful than others, smarter than others, wealthier than others, climb up the ladder, so to speak, maybe in our sports clubs or in our workplace, whatever. We're going to be number one, and we look down on others. Or corporately, you know, I'm part of this political group. I'm not like those dumb people who are part of the other political group. Or we do with our food we eat. Well, I'm vegetarian, I'm vegan, I'm keto, I'm carnivore, I'm whatever else. And then we, you know, not, it's not wrong to be part of a group. It's not wrong to be part of a political group. It's not wrong to be a vegetarian or eat in a certain way or anything else. Okay, but human pride and self-righteousness attaches itself very easily to these group identities. And so we need to be careful. And inevitably, if Christ is not our justification, your human heart needs some justification. And if you're doing it based on human works or human identity, you're going to look down on others. And we try to then address these injustices in the world without a God of justice or without a Redeemer who turns unjust people into just people. When we do that, we end up just flipping it all around on its head. And instead of oppressing one group of people, we flip it all around and end up oppressing another group of people. And that's human history right there for you, without a Redeemer. Lastly, as we see, you know, when the Bible talks about racism, it's usually not talking about superficial things like hair color or pigment of skin or accent or language, okay? It's a little different. So, like, you may have heard that verses, you know, in like the South, for example, in the South African apartheid and in different times and places, you know, people use some verses from the Old Testament to sort of justify racism. Usually they're taken very much out of context, because when the Bible talks about sort of ethnic identity, it's not talking primarily about this hard and fast thing you're born into and can never change. When God gives a specific identity to the Hebrew people in the Old Testament, which can maybe sometimes be used against interracial marriage or anything like this. No, God is simply saying to the Hebrew people, when he says to the sons of Israel, don't take foreign wives, he's not talking about, he's not saying anything against interracial marriage at all. Not in the way that we understand it. He's saying, he's saying, listen, to all you Israelite boys, don't be marrying girls who worship pagan gods. Because if you do, your heart's going to be seduced away from worshiping me, and you're going to worship other gods. That's not saying you can never worship somebody from a different color of skin or a different, no, not at all. In fact, one whole book of the Bible, the book of Ruth, was about a Moabite woman. She was born in the nation of Moab. They worshiped the god Chemosh. And then when she encounters Israel, she converts. She converts her ethnic identity. Primarily, that means she started worshiping Israel's God. And then she marries a Hebrew man who ended up, you know, they ended up being the great-grandparents of King David, a woman who was originally Moabite but became Hebrew. And so when it has those sort of ethnic identities, it's not to look down on others. It's to preserve the worship of God. And that's still today, as Christians, we would say, listen, if you're a young person, you're thinking maybe of getting married, and you're following Jesus, there's a lot of wisdom. There's a lot of very good wisdom in wanting to marry somebody else who also worships Jesus and wants to follow Jesus. If you are going in this direction and your life is based around pleasing Jesus and someone else has a different life goal, that's going to create a lot of tension and difficulty in your marriage. It has nothing to do with the pigment of their skin. It has nothing to do with what race you are. It has to do with what is the primary determinative factor of your life. Is that at the center of your culture, is it a commitment to Christ? If it is, you probably want to marry somebody else who shares that same commitment. And so this all comes down to, you know, from the outside, we would see this Persian king, and we would see this Jewish woman, and we would see this Amalekite guy. Now, from a Western perspective, they would all kind of look the same. They'd all be olive-skinned and dark-haired Middle Easterners. Now, among themselves, they'd probably be able to pick up kind of subtle physical differences. But primarily, they looked a lot alike. But there was very different ethnic, cultural, religious dynamics behind all three. And this created the ancient feud between the Amalekites and the Jews. The Amalekites hated the Jewish people, which went back almost 1,000 years. And now Haman thinks he's going to be the great Amalekite guy that finally wipes out all the Jews. And he doesn't know that the woman he's chatting with and smiling at and drinking wine with, that she is Jewish. All right. We get to the point, the climax, where the king looks over. He looks over to he looks over to Esther. And he asks this question for the third time now. What is it that you want? I'll do anything, up to half my kingdom, and you can have it. Yeah. And she says this. She says the great line that she's probably rehearsed so many times. She says, if I've obtained your approval, my king, and if the king is pleased to spare my life, this is my request, and spare my people. This is my desire, for my people and I have been sold out to destruction, death, and extermination. If we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept silent. Indeed, the trouble wouldn't be worth burdening the king. In a very lovely and humble way, she asks, please spare my life, of my family, of my people. And then she quotes from the edict that had gone out that Haman drafted up, in which the king had signed off on, and says, you know, where the Jews were supposed to be sold out to destruction, death, and extermination. She says, my people have been sold out to these things. Now, there's something subtle here we can easily miss the politics and the intrigue of her lines. Because in Persian culture, the king was at the top, and everybody else in the whole empire was Xerxes' slave. Okay? He was at the height of power, and even all the nobles, even all the elites, even the viceroy Haman, and even the queen. I mean, everybody was his slave. Okay? Now, that might not be our understanding of what slavery is, but in Persian thought, it certainly was. He made the shots, and everybody was supposed to do what he said. And she is saying, we have been sold as slaves to. Now, she's kind of using this in the passive voice. Because who is it that sold them as slaves? Well, it would have been Xerxes. It would have been the king. He, in a way, sold them off to Haman. Because Haman came and said, listen, I know the treasuries are a bit low because of that failed war with Greece. The nation needs a lot of money. If you let me take this rebellious, nasty little group of people who aren't Persian and who aren't doing things the Persian way, and let me loot them or kill them or enslave them, I can make sure that money gets filtered back into the national system. And he goes, okay, well, do whatever's best. Implicit in this is that Haman is kind of rivaling himself to the king and using this. And we've seen this previously in the book. Haman's the viceroy, but he does these little things that leave us speculating. Was his hope to be king one day? Was he hoping a coup might happen? To actually sit on the throne himself? And that's sort of implicit in this. We have been sold as slaves. In other words, your majesty, the queen is saying, your majesty, I am no longer yours. I have been sold to somebody else. And the king, he's a bit confused. He's a bit shocked. Is this a joke? You know, they've all been drinking wine. Maybe he's thinking, hey, what's up, woman? What are you saying? You crazy? Someone sold you and your people? You're mine. You're my queen. And everyone's my slave. What's going on? Who is this? Who would do such a thing? He says. And why don't we go ahead and put up that picture, Ben? Can you put up this picture? Great. This is a painting here. Do we see that? That's by Ernst Norman, British painter. 19th century Orientalist of this scene here. So Haman had accused the Jewish people of being rebellious and seditious. So on the basis of that accusation, that he had brought in this death edict against all the Jews. Okay? So Esther and all the Jewish people had been living under this accusation that they were a rebellious people and that they should die. And now Queen Esther stands up. When the king says, who has done this? Who's trying to rival me? Who's trying to take my queen and her people and make them his own slaves? You're my slaves. And she goes, the adversary and the enemy is this evil Haman. Okay, and this is the beginning of the downfall of Haman. This is a powerful moment. The tension in the room, you can feel it. You know, Haman is shocked. It says Haman stood terrified before the king and the queen. Accusation is a very powerful spiritual force in our world. It comes in the world because of sin, because we're insecure. We know on the inside we're not who we should be. And so we feel accused and condemned and guilty and shamed very easy. Sometimes that's justified. Sometimes we've done terrible things and the rightful response is maybe we should feel ashamed because we've done shameful things. Other times, we stand under a false accusation. We think we're not good enough, we're not loved, we're too ugly, we're too unsuccessful, that we're failures. And all that is just the great accuser of our souls. The Bible speaks of a different accuser. Now, for Queen Esther, the great adversary was Haman. But throughout the Bible, the great adversary is this force of evil in the universe that we call Satan or the Satan. It is the one that brings accusation against us before God. Look at those humans. Look how sinful they are. Look how dirty they are. You need to judge them. You need to punish them. They've sinned. You're a righteous God. You need to condemn them. That's the accusation that humanity lives under. Some of you feel that. You feel the accusations. You're constantly, you have so much negative thought in your mind. You're constantly condemning yourself, constantly telling yourself you're a nobody, or you're not good enough, you can never do that. You can never achieve what it is that God is calling you to achieve and do. And it's just negative, and it leads you to depression a lot. What is that? That is the adversary. Now, once again, sometimes these things are justified. And sometimes we do something shameful. But when that happens, though, whenever God convicts us and whenever he shines his light on something evil we've done, it's always very specific. And there's the hope of redemption. Hey, you've done this wrong. Turn around, repent, change so we can set this right. That's when shame is used the right way. But the adversary wants to come in and bring this vague blanket, you're just a nothing and a nobody type shame. And there's no hope. There's no direction for redemption and repentance. In this moment, Queen Esther, she then turns it around. And she accuses the accuser. Now, her accusation is true. Haman's accusation was largely false. Yes, it was true that the Jews had their own group identity within the Persian Empire, but it's not true that they were rebellious, anarchist sort of people. They generally respected authority. They just, you know, they maintained their own religious traditions and things, and there are some things they wouldn't compromise on, but they weren't rebellious in the way that Haman had made them out to be. That was a false accusation. Esther's accusation now against Haman is absolutely true. What she's saying is the truth. The first thing was built on a lie, and she is now reversing the thing and she's accusing the accuser. Now, for us Christians, this is our great hope. We get this in Revelations chapter 12, where it says, you know, now the kingdom, the power and the kingdom authority of our God and the kingdom of his Christ have now come. For the accuser of the brothers, the one who accuses us before the throne of God, has been cast down. That in Jesus coming, in Jesus dying, in Jesus rising again for his people, those accusations of the enemy against us have been brought to nothing. We've been delivered from our accuser. We've been delivered from our adversary. This is our great Christian hope. And in this, is Esther's like a little picture of Jesus. You know, she's stepping in the place, and the great enemy wants to wipe out the people of God, she's reversing fortunes. Powerful picture, isn't it? It says, Haman stood terrified and angered by this. The king arose. You know, he goes out into his garden. He needs to think. Now, King Xerxes, he loved nature. He loved trees. One historian records that when the army was marching from Persia to Greece with all his army, he stopped the whole army just so he could get off his palanquin and go stare at a tree for a while. He was very meditative for him, nature. And he goes out in the garden, he needs to think because he's angry. But he don't know what to do with that anger because he realized he's been had. Haman has played him. And in the name of efficiency and money, this rival has now laid claim to over his queen. But he signed off on it. Remember, Xerxes signed the paper. And as soon as Xerxes' signature was on it, he can't say, oops, I made a mistake. The whole Persian legal system depended on the fact that the emperor could never make a mistake, that these edicts from the emperor were irrevocable. And so he goes out, he's angered, but he doesn't really know what to do. He can't be mad at Haman for issuing an edict that he signed off on. He can't get rid of him. He can't dispose him from his job. He can't fire him for something he signed on to. But Haman remained. And he realized the king was angry at him. So he pleads with Esther for his life. And it says he fell on her sofa. Now this is definitely the end for him. There were laws, not only cultural customs, but actual laws in Persia, where a man could never be alone in a room. A man could never be alone in a room with one of the king's concubines. If a man was alone in a room with one of the king's concubines, it was just death for that man. And in public, so if there's this mixed party of men and women outdoors or in the public, and you know the emperor shows up with maybe 6 or 8 or 10 or however many harem girls around him, kind of draping themselves over him, no man was allowed within 7 steps of one of those girls. He always had to be at least 7 steps away from a concubine in public. And this was the law, you know, and there are consequences for that. But now Haman, he falls on the sofa, presumably he reaches out his hand, maybe touches her foot, he's trying to plead with her. The king walks back in and he sees this. And he actually, out of his mouth, he says, would he actually violate the queen while I am in the palace? And as soon as the statement left the king's mouth, Haman's face was covered. Now the king was surrounded at any one time by 1,000 bodyguards called immortals. And so as soon as he says something, these bodyguards are quick to act. And they cover up his face, and you know, they, in today's language, you say they handcuffed him, you know. And Harbona, one of the royal eunuchs, says, there is a gallows, 75 feet tall at Haman's house that he made for Mordecai, who gave the report that saved the king. The king commanded, hang him on it. You get this idea, maybe Haman rather, wasn't that popular. As soon as he does something wrong, man, those eunuchs, those servants are quick to say, oh, actually, he was planning on murdering Mordecai, you know, the guy who helped save your life. So, you know, if you're looking to execute someone, here's a good way to do it. They were quick to help the king out on that one. And he gets hung on the tree Mordecai or Haman had crafted this giant pole, 75 feet high. He wanted to impale Mordecai on. And instead, he gets, instead of that being his great victory, that's his great defeat. For us Christians, that's kind of our hope as well. You know, the great story of the Bible of redemption is that the enemy of our souls thought they were destroying Jesus when they hung him on a tree, when they put him on the cross. And yet, he, in his resurrection, his death actually became the source of our life, became the source of our victory over our accuser, over our adversary. He now shares his life with us. We are alive. We have hope. We are sons and daughters of Adam and Eve. And yet because Christ is risen from the dead, we can be sons and daughters of God as well, that a new life can fill us, that we can have hope over our adversaries, that when the enemy comes to accuse us and says, look at all the sin that you did, the sin that you committed, we can look at him and actually agree with them and say, yeah, we did all that, but I have a new life in me. I am no longer just a son of Adam or a daughter of Eve. I'm a son and daughter of God. And there's a new life in me that delights in God and that God is perfecting. And that it's not just the life of Adam and Eve. Yes, we are part of one race, the human race, but as Christians, we are now part of a redeemed race. We are part of two races at once. And ultimately, our identity comes not from Adam, but from Christ Jesus, through whom we are. This is why we use the term born again. We are born into one race, the human race, but we are born again into a new race. And we call other people, and we don't go around condemning people for that. We don't act like the adversary making accusations. We invite people into this new race of new life. If you're naturally an accusative person, whether you're a Christian or not, that's the enemy's work. I don't go around, and you see this on social media all the time. Social media is full of accusation. People let out all their accusation on social media, it seems, you know. Those stupid conservatives, those stupid liberals, those stupid whatever, that's where we accuse these different groups. Now, the debate and discussion and differences, yeah, that's all great. You can have those. But there's this spirit of accusation that comes where we just want to put other people down. If you're a Christian, one of the things you learn when you come to Christ is how to turn your accusations into intercessions. When you see a fault in somebody, instead of pointing at that fault and accusing that person for that fault, you begin to pray for that person in that fault. God, I see a fault in someone, but instead of pointing it out and accusing it and exposing it, I'm going to begin to pray for that person. That redemption would come in that area. That healing would come in that area. And we do that in politics. We do that within the church. We do that within families, in our interpersonal relationships. Who is it you're tempted to accuse right now? Maybe someone you work with, maybe a family member. And maybe, you know, maybe they deserve it. But we're instruments of redemption, not accusation. We turn our criticisms into prayers. So what happens now? Well, Haman is killed, and then the queen divulges her true identity to the king. And it says that the king then called Mordecai. She says, hey, I have this adopted father named Mordecai. He is one of your civil servants, and he's the guy who helped save your life and that you've said should be honored. He comes into the king's presence. The king meets him, and he knows Mordecai's loyal to him because he's involved. He already helped save his life. And so he gives him Haman's position. Now, this would be a great end of the story right here. You know, you could see Mordecai, who was Esther's cousin, an adopted father, kind of a complex relationship there, but an adopted father and cousin. And at this point, you know, hey, I haven't seen you since you were 15 and now you're 20. What have you been up to for the last 5 years? You know, it's kind of a glorious, sentimental sort of reunion here. But they don't just sit around and catch up. You know, they've been able to communicate through a series of messengers and servants and sent a few letters back and forth to each other. This is the first time they're in the same room again. This is the first time they're seen. They're able to, you know, these are two very close people. They're family. They love each other. And yet, the story doesn't just end with them being reunited. They have work to do. Because this edict, though Haman is dead, his work is still in motion. The king's edict cannot be revoked. Haman drafted this law to exterminate the Jews Xerxes has signed off on it, and under Persian law, that cannot be revoked because the emperor is perfect. So though Mordecai is the new prime minister, or the new viceroy, we'd say, and though he's reunited with Esther, that's not necessarily happily ever after. They have to undo the work of Haman, and will they be able to be successful? Well, we're going to talk about that in the next week or two. How do they undo? Haman's gone, but how do they undo what Haman has done? How do they save the lives of their people? When we look at the story from this week, we see Haman, a guy totally given over to self-promotion. And there's something in us that kind of rejoices that, you know, he got what's coming to his. He's been promoting himself. He wanted to take other people out, and then he reaped what, you know, he ended up reaping what he sowed. But, you know, and we rejoice when we see that. Very easily, when we read the Bible, we delight when we see that happening to the bad guys, you know. And we often read the Bible and we insert ourselves in as the good guys. That's not the healthiest way to read the Bible. There's a little bit of Haman that lives in all of us. It lives in me. It lives in you. We have a Haman inside of us that's given over to self-promotion. It's given over to pride. That's, you know, tries to see ourselves as a somebody. And we want to eliminate those Jews over there. Not for us, probably everyone listening. We don't have anything personal against Jewish people. Maybe some of us listening are Hebrew by heritage. Fine, great, but we have an other. There's us, and then there is the other, the cultural other, the ethnic other, the dietary, whatever, you know, the people who are outside our group identity that we look down on. We naturally build ourselves up both individualistically and corporately, and we can bring accusations against the other. Who are your others? Maybe it's a political other or a social other, a religious other. In some ways, pray for those others. Don't accuse them. Pray for them. Seek to be a blessing to them. This is why Jesus said, love your enemies. Jesus wasn't so foolish as to think, hey, humans don't have enemies. Of course we have enemies. We have cultural and social others that we're very different from, and we naturally rub against the grain of. Jesus says, love them. Pray for them. You know. And that's a very hard thing to do when oppression dynamics and injustice happen, like we've seen this last week. The groups do not necessarily want to love and bless and pray for one another at all. They want vengeance. They want justice. Jesus says love. Love them. Bless it. And when Jesus said that to the Jewish people of his day, they were being oppressed by the Romans. It wasn't easy to hear then. It's not easy to hear now. We are saved. We are saved by Jesus Christ dying on a tree. Naturally, we're a lot like Haman, you see. We want the kingdom for ourselves. We see Xerxes sitting on his throne. We see God on his throne. And we're like Adam and Eve. We want the kingdom for ourselves. We want to call the shots over our life. We don't want to, all these things in our lives, we don't want to give thanks for them as gifts from God. We want to say we earn them and deserve them and they're ours by right. Like Haman, we lust for the kingdom for ourselves. We want that power and that glory. We don't really want to give glory to God. We don't want to give thanks to God. We want to claim it for our own. It's our right. It's our kingdom. We don't want to bow the knee to anybody. We lust for that power and authority like Adam did, like Eve did, like Haman did. We should be the ones hanging on that tree. But instead, Jesus Christ comes, and even in our pride and self-righteousness, he comes and he dies in our place. He dies on that tree for us, to redeem us, to save us. We're a lot like Haman, but Jesus Christ came to save the Hamans of this world. Instead of self-promoting, power-hungry, self-justifying people, to turn them into his servants and his friends. And Esther, we're invited to be like Queen Esther. You know, it's interesting. She does not come with a knife and stab Haman in the back. That's not her way of dealing with things. And that shouldn't be our way of pursuing justice. As Christians, we are dispensers of mercy in this world. One day, Jesus Christ will come to judge the world perfectly. And he will do that. We can trust that one day he will ensure that perfect justice is done and that ultimately nobody gets away with anything. That is our great hope as believers. If you don't have that hope, you become desperate and you need justice here and now, and you hop onto any calls or any mechanism that you think might help bring justice, which once again very often just creates more injustice. But we have a hope that justice will come to the world, and we're looking forward to that. We are like Esther in some ways. We are looking to our king. Esther was looking to Xerxes to bring about justice for her. She was not trying to take up a knife and stab Haman in the back herself. She went to her king. As Christians, we come to our king and we make our prayers known to him in a context of relationship. Sometimes people, you know, they say, well, I prayed and God didn't do it. I was in a bad circumstance and I prayed and God didn't change my circumstance. Well, you know, God's God and he can answer. He can certainly answer any prayer he wants to. And many times, ungodly people who have lived ungodly lives in a moment of desperation, they call out to heaven, and God in his mercy chooses to answer. And yet, we are called first and foremost into relationship with God to know him. And sometimes people say, well, I tried praying once and it didn't happen. I say, well, you know, how much time do you spend just getting to know God? Are you in relationship with God? Do you obey him? Do you try to listen to him? Do you read his word? Do you spend time talking with him and giving thanks? Oh, no, I don't do anything like that. Esther built her whole request on her relationship with Xerxes. You know, she threw two meals for him. She pleased him. She dressed in his favorite clothes. And there was a relationship there she was cultivating, a love relationship. And it was in that context of that love relationship that she made her requests known. That's the sort of relationship we're called to with Christ. One of love and obedience, delight. And in that, we let our requests be made known. It doesn't mean that God necessarily answers every single prayer. But when Christ gives those promises of ask and it shall be given to you, it's in context of his followers, loving him and walking with him. And when we have his heart, we can let our prayers and our requests be made known. Those people that you know in church and in other places maybe that see lots of answers to prayer, usually they're the ones you spend a lot of time alone with God, getting to know him. Doesn't mean that God doesn't sometimes answer the prayer. Prayerless or godless people, he can do whatever he wants. And yet we're called to this position of relationship. All right. Thank you for tuning in this week. Next week, we're going to continue on. How does Esther, how does Mordecai, how do they save? How do they save their people? How are they going to do it? Well, we'll find out. For now, let's celebrate the death and the destruction of our great accuser. The fact that Jesus Christ in his death, his resurrection, has brought a victory for us. A lot like Esther has won in this chapter over Haman. It was a great day. It was a great day when that man was destroyed and they became hope for the people of God. Now for you and me, through the resurrection of Christ, we have a similar hope. See you next week.